Okay. Hi, everybody. So this is going to be our last class, at least for this go round. And we are going to be dealing with a few different things. We'll talk about that in a minute. Oh, just one second. Just do one thing. Don't disturb us. Okay. So let me share my sources. Meanwhile, of course, our learning, as always, dedicated to the immediate return of the hostages and the safety and success of our soldiers and the refuah shlema of anyone who needs a refuah shlema. Okay, sorry. Here we go. All right. I'll put the sources in the chat again in another couple of minutes. And let's get started. Okay, so what we're going to do this time is we're going to finish up a little from last time. Some of the things we talked about with the city, we didn't completely finish. Last time we finished with streets, with a lithostrotos, right, with the highway and the platea, the forum, the plaza. Today we're going to look a little bit at the what's called the Rehovah Shel Ir, the city square, and also the Beit Midrash. But then really we're going to transition to talking about women and their accessories. And we're also going to talk a little bit about clothing, men's clothing, not only women's clothing. And obviously there are many, many more things we could talk about. So women is very tricky. In general, it's very tricky to know about the lives of ordinary people, although Chazal certainly talk about everything under the sun. But women, we don't always get such a picture of what life was like for everyday women. We get some extraordinary women, right? Because I'll talk about people like Bruria was a Talmidei Chachamah, or Rachel, the wife of Rabbi Akiva. We don't get a sense of everyday women. Chazal tend to not have a wonderful opinion of women, certainly on an intellectual level. We have to look a little bit deeper. By the way, I will very much recommend there's a new book out by someone named Gila Fine, which is excellent, excellent, which is called The Madwoman in the Rabbi's Attic, where she takes a look at six different rabbinic stories about women, and she kind of does a deep reading and really comes up with some very interesting conclusions. Highly recommended, Gila Fine. Okay, so we have to look sort of beneath the surface. We have to look at archaeology. We have to see what Chazal don't say, right? We want to also see if there are any depictions of women. Now, in general, we have so many depictions of men, right? We don't have so many pictures altogether. We're not talking in this class about imagery in Judaism, but is important to discuss maybe in a future class. We sometimes do have some pictures. So these are some great pictures that we have. Two of them from synagogue, and one of them from a private home. Okay, if you take a look, we'll start with the one all the way on the right. This amazing portrait, right? This is made out of stones. This is a mosaic. It's really hard to believe. From a villa of obviously a very wealthy in Sipori, in the Galil. We're not sure that it was the home of a Jewish family. This is the centerpiece of a gorgeous mosaic in their living room, which a lot of it is about the festival and the cult of Dionysus. Could these have been very assimilated Jews? Were they non-Jews? We know Sipori had all sorts of people living there. But this lady, who got the name Mona Lisa of the Galilee, okay, she's really gorgeous. And we don't know. Who is she? Is she the mistress of the house, right? Is she the one that was paying the artist and so he made her look really good? Did she really look like this? We don't know. But we can get a little bit of a sense of what did women wear? Not so much since it's only her portrait, her face, but we do have some earrings, some jewelry. Okay. The other two are not depictions of real women. I'm just going to go into the chat one more time. Yes, she's somebody with a lot of money for sure. Or her husband is, we don't know. I just put the sources in again for anybody who didn't get them. Okay, the other two women are depictions of the seasons. Okay, one of the classic designs that we find in synagogues in the Galilee is the zodiac. Okay, signs of the zodiac. And in the corners around the zodiac, you have representations of each of the four seasons. And for some reason, these seasons are always women. So the one all the way on the left, this is from Beta Alpha. The style is much more kind of naive, primitive. This is Mrs. Spring. She is from Beta Alpha. One thing that's nice, and we'll come back to this, is we get to see some of her jewelry, right? Now, this is not a real person, but it's presumably based on a real person. So we've got nice earrings. We've got a lovely tiara headdress kind of a thing. She's got a choker. She's got a necklace. We're going to see a lot of these things when we read about descriptions of jewelry in Chazal. So this is Mrs. Spring. She comes from Beta Alpha. Over here, we have Mrs. Summer from Chamat Tveria. You can see it says Tkufat Tammuz. Tammuz is the summertime. She's got these accessories, right? Her sickle so that she can harvest the wheat. But she's also got also earrings, a necklace, a nice headdress, right? So these are great to give us a sense of what did women wear, what might they have looked like, right? And we'll come back to that when we get to jewelry. Okay, so that's our ladies, but we're not up to the ladies yet. First, we're going to go to the city. Okay, so Chazal talk about something called Rehovah shel Ir, the city square, the main square, and what happens there. Now it's interesting because if you look at sources from First Temple times, right, both in Tanakh as well as if you look at reality in archaeology, where does most of the action in the city take place? At the gate to the city, right? At Shar Ha'ir, think of Eshet Chayil, right? Noda b'Sha'arim Ba'ala, or think of Rut and Boaz, where Boaz goes and there's chalitza at the gate of the city, or there's purchasing happening at the gate of the city. The gate of the city is where things happen. By the time we get to Second Temple times, cities are much more open. There are fewer walled cities. Gates are not so important anymore. And instead, the action moves, and this is a result of Hellenism, the action moves to what the Greeks call the agora, okay? The marketplace or the public square. Now, if you're in a big city, Jerusalem, Tsipori, Tveria, right? There's a market all the time. But if you're in a small town, like Chorazim, which is what this is a picture of over here. Okay, Chorazim, nice Jewish village on the north of the Kinneret, not particularly big. And it didn't have a regular everyday market. What it had is what Chazal talk about twice a week, Monday and Thursday is market day. People come, they set up, and they go to this Rehovah shel Ir, this city square. This is where the action is happening. Now, what sources do we have about this besides it being the place of the market? Okay, when we have bad things happen to us, right? Israel knows to come together and to pray and to beseech God. Sometimes they go into the synagogue, but if things get really bad, and this is in the Gemara in Ta'anit, okay, this is talking about when there's not rain, right? What do? There's a progression of what we do if there isn't rain in Cheshvan and Kislev, right? As it gets worse, we do more drastic things. And one of the things we do is they remove the ark to the main city square and place burnt ashes on the ark. Okay? Instead of praying for rain in the synagogue, we actually take the Aron out of the synagogue, which is interesting because it tells us that there were movable arks, and we know that this was true up until a certain point. We're used to that permanent Aron in the Beit Knesset, but there were movable ones. We actually even have a depiction of an ark on wheels in Kfar Nachum. But here they take it out to the city square and they place ashes upon the ark. And the Gemara says, why? Right? Why do we go out to the square? Beyond the practical reason that perhaps we can accommodate more people than we could inside the structure of the synagogue, right? The Gemara gives two more spiritual, theological answers. Rabbi Chiya bar Abba said, to say we cried out in private and we were not answered, we will therefore disgrace ourselves in public, right? It's embarrassing that it hasn't rained. It means we've sinned, but we don't care. We're going to call out to you, Hashem, even in public, right? And this is what we're going to do. Reish Lakish says, even a stronger idea. We have been exiled, right? Coming out of the Beit Knesset and into this public square is a form of exile. May our exile atone for us. It's a little bit easier than going into actual galut, right? This is kind of a symbolic exile. Let's go out. Another time when we use the public square is the opposite, is for happy times, okay? When they would go up to Jerusalem to bring their first fruits, their bikurim, it was a very ceremonious thing, not only when they got to Jerusalem, but on the way to Jerusalem. How were the bikurim taken up to Jerusalem? All the inhabitants of the city of the Ma'amad, right? We have groups of Kohanim that travel together, that go up together to the Beit HaMikdash. They're called Mishmarot, and their cities that they come from is the Ma'amad. All of the inhabitants of the city of the Ma'amad would assemble in the city of the Ma'amad. They would spend the night in the open street, and they would not enter any of the houses. Right? This is partly an issue of impurity. They don't want to become impure, but it's partly this is making this much more celebratory. Everyone's going together. We're making a really big deal out of it. It reminds us of the beautiful Midrash about Elkanah, the father of Shmuel. Elkanah, the Chachamim ask, why does Elkanah merit to have a son like Shmuel HaNavi, who's a really important guy? And they say people had forgotten about the Mishkan. They weren't going to the tabernacle. And what would Elkanah do every year? Right, it tells us in the beginning of Sefer Shmuel, Miyamim Yamima, he would go up every year to the Mishkan with his family. The Medrash adds that every year he would go a different route and he would make sure that he had to spend the night in a town on the way. And he wouldn't go into anybody's house. He would sleep outside so that people would say to him, "Oh, where are you going?" "I'm going to the Mishkan." "Really? I haven't been in the Mishkan in years. I'm going to come with you." Right? So it's a beautiful reflection of this same idea. Now, one last thing. If we're using the public square for these things, for prayer, for Bikurim, does the public square have some kind of holiness? Okay? And the Mishnah and the Gemara kind of raise this question. Ultimately, they don't. They say no. But it's an interesting thing to raise, right? We have this idea that you cannot use money, use the proceeds of something holy to buy something profane. You can only go up in holiness. So if you sell the synagogue, you can't use that money to just buy a building. You can always have to get something more holy. Residents of a town, this is our last source here, who sold the town square may purchase a synagogue with the proceeds, right? Because the synagogue is higher up than the town square, but it means that the town square has some holiness to it. Ultimately, the Gemara is going to reject this idea because it's only temporary holiness, but it's interesting that they suggest this at all, that there is holiness to this town square because it can be used as a place of prayer. And we've seen this, right, in the past few years, certainly in the time of COVID, when we prayed outside and you had all these minyanim in people's backyards, in people's parking lots. We elevated the outdoors to be like a synagogue. Do I need to put the sources in the chat one more time? Let's see. Let's do that once. Okay. I will look at the questions at the end. All right. One last thing about towns, and then we're going to transition. I will do a little bit about synagogues also. The Beit Midrash. Okay, we hear about Beit Midrash all over Chazal. Okay, we hear about the rabbis in the Beit Midrash. We hear about rabbis being kicked out of the Beit HaMidrash. We hear about a rabbi like Rabban Gamliel who limited access to the Beit HaMidrash. And the question is this an actual separate place from the synagogue? It's a really interesting question because from the literature, it seems like it is. From archaeology, we have not found such a thing. But on the other hand, how are we going to find it, right? What's it going to look like? How is it going to look different even today? Go into some of the famous Batei Midrash, right? Go into Har Etzion here in the Gush or Lakewood or Panovich. How does it look different than a synagogue? It doesn't look so different. You know it's a Beit Midrash by the fact that there are hundreds of students sitting there and studying, but you don't see it from the structure. So we have a lot of references to a Beit Midrash, and we also have references to a Beit Midrash that is different than a Beit Knesset. Okay, so just I brought you one reference here, but really, like I said, so many, right? Ein Beit Midrash b'li chidush. There cannot be a study hall without a novelty, without something new. Okay. Then we have other sources like this. Rav Papi said in the name of Rava, to convert a building from a synagogue into a study hall is permitted, from a study hall into a synagogue is prohibited. Same idea like we saw before, right? Raising it in Kedusha. So this seems to be two separate buildings. Here's another one. Rabbi Levi Bar Chiya said, one who leaves the synagogue and enters the study hall and engages in Torah study is privileged to receive the divine presence. He left one, he went into the other. There are two separate places. Rabbi Ami and Rabbi Asi, despite the fact that they had 13 synagogues in Tiberias, would only pray between the pillars where they studied. Okay, now this is an interesting one. This tells us not that they had a Beit Midrash, but that they had a place where they sat and studied. Maybe that's all a Beit Midrash is. Maybe people sat outside under a tree. Right? We have the probably the most famous story in all of the Gemara about the rabbis, which is Tanuro Shel Achnai, the oven of Achnai, where Rabbi Elazar ben Hyrcanus goes against all the rabbis, and he, in order to prove his point, he has the carob tree fall over, and he has the aqueduct go backwards. Those things seem to be outside. On the other hand, he has the walls of the Beit Midrash fall in. So unclear what's going on. Do we have any evidence of a Beit Midrash? So first of all, we have this great inscription up here on the top. It's from the Golan, and it's a lintel, right, for a door, and it says, "Zehu Beit Midrasho Shel Rabbi Elazar HaKapar." This is the study hall or the school of Rabbi Elazar HaKapar, who's somebody we hear about in a lot of different places in the Gemara. Okay, so this seems to definitely be a structure. It's the doorway. Okay? Other places like a big basilica, a big building in Tveria. Was it a synagogue? Was it a Beit Midrash? We have another building like this in Beit Sharim. Unclear, right? So it's kind of an open question, but a very interesting question. So far, archaeologists have not been able to figure out what would signify a Beit Midrash more than a synagogue. Now let's go back to Rabbi Ami and Rabbi Asi for a second. Why won't they pray in the synagogue? 13 synagogues. We've only found one so far. Right? Why won't they pray in the synagogue? And this is where you get to this very interesting idea that is, which was phrased very nicely by Professor Yisrael Levine, who wrote a lot about ancient synagogues, and was really in the forefront of the many, many discoveries that were made in the last century of ancient synagogues, showing us that there were so many different styles and different ways of decorating. And here's what he says. The synagogue, more than any other Jewish institution of antiquity, demonstrates a fascinating synthesis of Jewish and non-Jewish elements within a single framework. The integration of these elements in every aspect of the institution, from the physical dimensions of art and architecture to the spiritual dimension of liturgy, offers a glimpse into the diverse and dynamic nature of Jewish life at the time, socially, religiously, and culturally. So on the one hand, the synagogue is actually a great window into what people were thinking, what was important to them, what was accepted by them. On the other hand, maybe people like Rabbi Ami and Rabbi Asi or others of the rabbis were not always so comfortable in the synagogue because it's much more a reflection of what people are doing. So, for example, right, we have synagogues with lots of imagery. Now, like I said, I'm not going to go into imagery today. We could do a whole section on that, but and the rabbis have different views on imagery. It's not a one-way thing. So, for example, these lions up here from Hamat Gader, okay, lions, maybe okay, maybe not. We're not always so thrilled about animals in the synagogue. What about symbols of the zodiac? What about a symbol of Helios, the sun god, riding a chariot, which we have in Chamat Tveria, which we have in Beit Alpha? Right? How comfortable were Chazal with that? Right? Then you have synagogues that are much more austere, for lack of a better word, like the synagogue in Bar'am down here, synagogue in Kfar Nachum, which perhaps the rabbis were more comfortable with. Then you have places like Chorazim, where not only do you have the austerity, the stone columns and everything else, but you actually have some decorations. And take a look at this decoration over here on the left. Okay, this is not a sun. It has a nice face in the middle. This is, whether you think so or not, this is a woman with very wild hair. Her name is Medusa. You might remember her from Greek mythology. Her hair is snakes. What on earth is she doing in the synagogue? She's in the synagogue because Greek mythology and Greek ideas and Roman ideas did enter into Jewish life. How comfortable did people feel with that? Obviously, some people felt very comfortable. So it's definitely could be a fault line where the community and the rabbinic authorities don't always see eye to eye. We look at the Mishnah, we look at the Gemara. This is the rabbis telling us what they think, but it doesn't tell us if people were following what the rabbis think. Okay. We're not going to go too much into synagogues. There really is a lot to talk there, but it is interesting to get a sense of that, and also to just be aware. And Professor Levine is a great survey of this. Over the last 5, 6, 7 decades, we've discovered more and more ancient synagogues, right? Many in the Golan and in the Galilee, and if 30 years ago, people were able to say, okay, we understand this type of synagogue was popular at this time and this type was popular at that time. Today, it's much more confusing. Okay? We have synagogues that are contemporary with each other. Some of them have mosaics, some of them don't. Some of them have this very impressive facade, some of them don't. It seems more place related than time related, but again, it's there are a lot of questions that we have about synagogue styles. Okay, let's transition to women. So, if we're talking about synagogues, one big question that we can ask is, okay, did women go to the synagogue? Now, this is again, it's a hard question to answer. We have sources that will talk about women in the synagogue. Were these women unusual or were they the norm? Okay. Now you're going to say, okay, well, was there a women's section in the synagogue? Wait, we're going to do that next. Okay, so hold your breath. But first, what do our sources say? Okay, so I brought us here two of our sources, and I brought us two sources from the New Testament. And you'll say, why the New Testament? Because the New Testament, at least in these sources, is what Chazal call Messiah lefitumo. They're sort of telling us an observation, something. They're not giving us directions about what to do. They're observing that this is what happens. It's sort of a by the way, and that's useful to us because it tells us what did people see. So let's start first with our Gemara here in Sota. Okay, a certain widow. That's already interesting, right? She's a widow, meaning chances are, although not necessarily, that she's older. She doesn't have children at home. She's able to go to synagogue, as opposed to a young woman who's not necessarily able to do that because she's watching her kids. A certain widow in whose neighborhood there was a synagogue, and despite this, every day she went and prayed in the study hall of Rabbi Yochanan. Rabbi Yochanan said to her, okay, and this also, Rabbi Yochanan, where does Rabbi Yochanan live? Tveria. We're going to see our next sources in Chamat, near Tveria. Maybe this is something that's common in the Galilee. I'm just thinking of that now. I don't know. Rabbi Yochanan said to her, my daughter, is there not a synagogue in your neighborhood? She said to him, my teacher, don't I attain a reward for all the steps I take while walking to pray in the distant study hall, right? Don't I get schar psiot? And you get a reward because it's a bigger effort to go. Okay, so that's one story. The next story is actually a very well-known story. We have variations on it. Rabbi Meir used to preach in the synagogue of Chamat every Friday night. I brought you a picture here of a mosaic from the synagogue of Chamat. Chamat is a little bit south of Tveria. This is a mosaic not from the time of Rabbi Meir. It's later, but okay, it's a nice illustration. And a certain woman there used to listen to his voice. She went to hear the preacher. One day he preached for a long time. She went and tried to enter her house, but found that the lamp had gone out. Right? Friday night, she gets home too late. The lights are already out. Her husband said to her, "Where have you been?" She said, "I was listening to the preacher." He said to her, "I swear you will never enter this house until you spit in the face of the preacher." And then, of course, the story goes on. It's a very well-known story about Rabbi Meir, who is always trying to make peace, even between, even with this man who's so contemptuous. But for our purposes, what's interesting is here's this woman. Her husband clearly is not supportive, and yet she goes every Friday night to hear the drasha. She goes to hear Rabbi Meir. Okay, our sources in the New Testament are in not in Eretz Yisrael. Okay, they are in Chutz La'aretz, they're in Asia Minor. We have two sources, both from the Book of the Apostles. And on Shabbat day, we went forth without the gate by the riverside, where it seemed likely there would be a place of prayer. And we sat down and spoke to the women, which were come together. Okay, so the women were the ones who came to this synagogue. And again, the same thing. When they had passed through Amphipolis, they went down to Apollonis and then to Thessalonica, where there was a synagogue of the Jews. And Paul is preaching, preaching, preaching. And many of the devout and of Greeks and women of the first rank, not a few. Okay, does this tell us that women go to shul? Some women, but not necessarily all women, which leads us to the important question of, was there a women's section? Was there an Ezrat Nashim? Now, just to preface this, by the Middle Ages, by the 11th century in Europe, for sure, we hear about machitza, we hear about a divider between the sexes, and Ezrat Nashim. Okay, so for sure, by the Middle Ages. What about before that? Right. So we have very interesting precedent from the temple, from the Beit HaMikdash. Right? In the Beit HaMikdash, you have different sections. The largest section is what's called the Ezrat Nashim. This is the Ezrat Nashim. As much as it sounds like our women's section, it's not, because clearly this is so large because it's for men and women together, and it's not just something that I'm inferring, it's actually what the text tells us. Okay, it's always mixed. This is where Yisrael, right, people who are not Levim, who are not Kohanim, can stand. They stand here to hear the Levim singing on the steps here. Okay, they do their preparations if they are Nazarites and they need to get their hair cut, or they're lepers, their mitzorayim, and they need to bring their korbanot, right? But we also can see that there's a higher place here. There's what's called a balcony, a gezuztra, and this is where we get to the source in the Gemara in Sukkah, okay, which talks about one time a year where the men and women were separated, and this is on Sukkot. Right? In the time of what we call Nisuch HaMayim, right, the Simchat Beit HaShoeva, the celebration of the place of the drawing of the water, right, the big party time, dancing and singing and juggling, right. This was a sequence of events. Take a look at the Gemara here in Sukkah. Sorry, I'm just going to erase this to get it out of my way. At the conclusion of the first festival day, right, this is Sukkot, the priests and the Levites descended from the Israelites' courtyard to the women's courtyard, where they would introduce a significant repair. What was that? Rabbi Elazar said, it is like what we learned. They surrounded the courtyard with a balcony, and they instituted that the women should sit above and the men below. The sages taught in the Tosefta, initially women would stand on the inside of the women's courtyard, the men were on the outside. They would come to conduct themselves with inappropriate levity. So the sages said the women should be on the outside, the men on the inside. Still was inappropriate. Therefore, they instituted that the women would sit above and the men below. Okay, we can understand that. Simchat Beit HaShoeva, there's a lot of partying, inappropriate. But the rest of the time, they're together. Okay, we have another great source that talks not only about the Ezrat Nashim, but right beyond these gates is what's called Ezrat Yisrael. It's a very narrow place where Yisrael can go in to put their hands on their sacrifices before they're sacrificed. And in the Tosefta, it says, La'olam lo nir'eit isha ba'azara, ela bish'at korbanah bilvad. The woman is never seen in the azara, in this area where the korbanot are given, except when she's giving her korban, meaning she is seen there when she's giving her korban. So it seems clear that from the Beit HaMikdash, you do not have a separation of men and women. Okay? I'll add to that, we have one Gemara That's, now there's a lot of Gemaras that talk about how women, you have to be careful around women, you have to separate, and you shouldn't have yichud, and you shouldn't have, be private, and you shouldn't go on journeys together. We have lots of sources like that. But sources about separating while we are in a structure together, we have this source. Right? Rav Kahana said, if there are men without in the outer chamber and women within, we have no fear of privacy, of yichud, that they're, it's going to be inappropriate. If there are men in the inner chamber and women in the outer, we have fear of privacy. And the Braita to the reverse was taught. Okay, so which is more appropriate if you have a mixed gathering, men on the outside, women on the inside, or vice versa? Abaye said, now that Rav Kahana ruled us while the Braita taught the reverse, let us act stringently. Abaye made a partition of jugs. Rava made a partition of canes. They made what we would call a machitza. This is the first time we hear about such a thing. Now, I'll add to that by saying that Chazal have dimensions and rules about everything. How big should your courtyard be? How big should your mikveh be? Okay? What's the dimensions of your burial chamber? Everything. We have no discussion of what your women's section should look like. We have no discussion besides this of what a mechitza should look like. It seems unlikely that Chazal, who are so detail-oriented, would not have talked about this. Now, what about archaeology? Okay. We have a couple of synagogues that have a second floor. Okay? This picture over here is a model of the synagogue in Beit Alpha. We have one in Susia. However, we don't know if the second floor was for women or was for something else. We have no proof of that. We do have an inscription from a synagogue in Asia Minor that talks about a woman donor sitting in the front row. Okay. Now, does all this mean that there was mixed seating? Maybe, or maybe not. Meaning, it goes back to our question that we asked before. If there are no women coming to the synagogue, we don't need a women's section for them. All right. So it could be that that's the situation, that there aren't women, and maybe once in a while there are women and they would come and they would sit in the same space, but we don't need to set aside separate space for them because they're not there. The other possibility is, and this is often a possibility in archaeology, we haven't found it yet. We don't know what it looks like. We don't know what to look for. And who knows what we're going to find. There are always surprises in archaeology. But so far, we don't have any great proof of a women's section. Okay. Moving along. One more thing about women and synagogues. So we have inscriptions that show that women were involved in the synagogue, certainly on the level of giving money, and perhaps even more than that. Okay, so these sources come from a book that was written a couple of decades ago by somebody named Dr. Bernadette Bruton, who looked at all the inscriptions from the land of Israel as well as from the diaspora that mention women, and all the kind of titles that they got. Elder, mother of the synagogue, right? Even Kohenet, right? Priestess. Now, everybody up till Bernadette Bruton said, these are honorary titles. She got them because her husband, that. She's the first one who says, no. Maybe women really were involved not only in giving money and not only in being the wives of important people, but they actually had jobs, whether in the lay or the religious leadership of the synagogue. This is controversial. Not everybody agrees with it, but it definitely shows us that there are women who are involved in the community, right? So take a look at the ones over here on the right. These are a couple from Eretz Yisrael, right? One's from Usafia in the Carmel, right? Brucha Khalifa, Khalifo, blessed is Khalifo, the wife of Rebbe, somebody we don't know, Dachir Latov, remembered for good. Okay, here's another one from Naaran, from the Jordan Valley near Jericho. Hey, Dechira Latov, Rivka, Itata of Pinchas, remembered for good, Rivka, the wife of Pinchas. Hey, Dechira Latov, Khalifa, Barat, Rabbi Safra. Khalifo should be remembered for good, the daughter of Rabbi Safra. Now, obviously, they're all being mentioned in relation to the men in their lives, but it doesn't mean that they weren't important. They were clearly important enough that we're putting their names in. Okay, this is one of the more unusual ones. This is not from Eretz Yisrael. This is from Smyrna in Turkey. Rufina, a Judean, right? Tells us she's Jewish. She gets the title Archisynagogos. Archisynagogos is a very important title. We hear about it in the synagogue in Jerusalem and in other places. Basically, it means the gabbai, right? It's the person who's in charge of the synagogue, who's taking care of all of the day-to-day mundane, right? When are the lights turned on? When are the doors locked? Right? All the things that the gabbai does, she gets this title. That's a pretty big deal. She prepared the burial niche for her freedmen and her slaves. Clearly, she's very wealthy, right? And all these different things about what happened in her, in her burial cave. Okay, so very interesting. How much are the women involved? They certainly are part of the community to some extent. Okay, let's go to jewelry, from being the leaders to wearing nice jewels. Who says they can't go together? Okay, so jewelry is timeless. Okay? We all like jewels. We all like the bling. But what did they wear? What did it look like? Okay, so we know from literary evidence that women had jewelry, and we also have archaeological evidence. Okay, so what are they wearing? Some things are familiar to us, some things are really lost in the mist of time. One of the places that's really helpful for understanding, we're going to see this source, a similar source in a few minutes, but for understanding what did people actually wear, is the Mishnayot in Shabbat, because Shabbat has many, many, many listings about what you are allowed to wear on Shabbat and what you are allowed to carry outside of your home on Shabbat, right? What's considered part of your outfit, right? And we have a lot of rules about jewelry, because jewelry, on the one hand, if it's not an essential part of your clothing, maybe you shouldn't be allowed to carry it out to a public space on Shabbat. Okay, we're assuming no Eruv. Okay. Number two, Chazal understood that women, men too, but women for sure, got it. I got a new necklace. My husband bought me a beautiful necklace. I'm very proud of it. When I go out and I meet my friends, I might want to take it off and show it to everybody. I want to take off that ring and let everybody pass it around and try it on. And that's going to be carrying in the public space. So we have a lot of rules about what you can carry. By the way, it tells us what did women wear. Okay, so we have this long list in the sixth chapter of the Mishnah in Shabbat. Okay, some of them we're familiar with, some not. Right? A woman may neither go out with a totefet or a savritin or a kavul. What are these things? We'll try to explain them. A woman may not go out with a city of gold, nor with a katella, nor with nose rings, nor with a ring that has no seal on it, or a needle that is not perforated. Okay, so let's start. Okay, a totefet. Totefet, if it sounds familiar, because it sounds like totafot. What are totafot? Totafot is the Torah word for tefillin, for phylacteries. So a totefet seems to be some kind of a box that she wore on her head. Some people suggest maybe with an amulet. Okay. A savritin seems to be some kind of a tiara. Maybe it's ribbons. Maybe it's what we see in this picture here. Right, that she has these things kind of hanging down. In general, women did not go out with their hair loose. Think about the sota, right? How she has her hair as a sign of disgrace. Her hair is parua. It's all messed up. Women would wear hairnets. Women would have their hair braided, somewhat covered, not necessarily covered like we cover today, but fixed up, right? Organized. Okay? A kavul seems to be some kind of a hairnet. Right, she had her hair done. City of gold, we're going to come up to in a minute. A katella seems to be a tight necklace, almost like a collar. Okay, by the way, these words sometimes are coming from Greek or Latin. Nose rings, a ring without a seal, a ring with a seal is kind of like a business accoutrement. That for sure you can't go out with. But even a ring without a seal on it, you can't go out with. And a needle, you can't have a needle that you would sew with. That for sure is muktzah Shabbos. But you can't even have a needle that's like a hairpin. Okay, so these are all different accessories. Now, here we're worried about carrying, but we have another source in Chazal that says, maybe women shouldn't be so ostentatious. Maybe they should only wear their jewelry inside, even when it's not Shabbat. Notably, Jewish women did not follow this rule. Our sages maintain that she is forbidden to wear them in public, even on a weekday, for people would stare at her if she did so, and that is discreditable to a woman. Ornaments were given to women to wear only inside her home. As I said, Jewish women, we wear our jewels, we bling it up. We have not listened to this Tanchuma. Okay, do we know what these things look like? So we have some amazing, we saw already the women from the seasons and from the Mona Lisa in the beginning. We also have women in the Roman world, and presumably, even though we're kind of in a backwater in the land of Israel, the styles trickle down, right? So presumably women in Eretz Israel were copying some of these styles. So we have these gorgeous frescoes from Pompeii, right? Pompeii, we'll remember, was covered in a volcano, a volcanic eruption, and everything in it was preserved. It's a terrible tragedy, but preserved for archaeologists. So here, our woman here on the left, she's got all these hair accessories, right? Her hair is definitely done in some way. She has what might be a sarvitin and a kabul. She's also wearing earrings. This woman has a different kind of headpiece, but mostly she has these beautiful earrings over here. Now, what about real jewelry? Occasionally in archaeology, we find real jewelry, right? There are gorgeous earrings that look like that are an image of the goddess Nike. That were discovered in excavations that were done in Mareshah, in the lowlands, in the Judean lowlands, in the city of David, in the excavations in the Givati parking lot. This is a copy that was made by the City of David gift shop, but one of these earrings with gold, with pearls, with emeralds was discovered. Absolutely stunning. Why was it there? Some poor lady lost her earring when she went on pilgrimage to Jerusalem, and we found it and we got to see it. So we do have some evidence of jewelry, not enough. The Mishnah talks about a city of gold, right? Let's just look back for a second, right? She can't go out with a city of gold. What's a city of gold? So the Gemara asked that question. Neither may a woman go out on Shabbat to the public domain with a city of gold. What is the meaning of a city of gold? Rabbah Bar Bar Chana said that Rabbi Yochanan said, Jerusalem of gold, Yerushalayim shel zahav, a gold tiara engraved with a depiction of the city of Jerusalem, like the one that Rabbi Akiva made for his wife. Okay? And then, of course, we have various stories about Rabbi Akiva and Rachel and their love story. And in one of them, the Gemara in Nedarim, we hear this story of the Jerusalem of gold. Rabbi Akiva became betrothed to the daughter of Bar Kalva Savua. When Bar Kalva Savua heard about their betrothal, he took a vow prohibiting her from eating all of his property. Despite this, she went ahead and married Rabbi Akiva. In the winter, they would sleep in a storehouse of straw, and Rabbi Akiva would gather strands of straw from her hair. He said to her, "If I had the means, I would place on your head a Jerusalem of gold." Right? It's a beautiful story. The poor young couple, and eventually Rabbi Akiva does make a fortune, and he does buy Rachel this city of gold. The wife of Rabban Gamliel is not pleased. She goes to her husband. She says, "How come I didn't get a piece of jewelry like that?" He says, "Did you do for me what Rachel did for Rabbi Akiva?" Not such a politic kind of an answer, but that was the answer. Now we know about this Yerushalayim shel Zahav, right? We know this story. We also know it from the beautiful song written by Naomi Shemer 50 plus years ago, right? Yerushalayim shel Zahav, where she takes so Naomi Shemer knew a lot of Torah, and she takes a lot of these ideas and she talks about this concept of Yerushalayim shel Zahav, but she takes the phrase from the Gemara. But what is less well known is that this is not only a Jewish idea. Okay? When the Mishnah says, Ir shel Zahav, a city of gold, it's actually talking about a very, very old idea that is found in cities throughout the ancient Near East and Rome. Okay? So take a look at this is a depiction of Darius the Great. Okay, the Persian king, and you can see that he's wearing this crown, but his crown is very specific. His crown, if you look at it, has these like spiky things coming out of it, right? Even today, if you ask a child to draw a crown, it will have those spiky things. Why? Because it's a skyline of a city. Okay? This is a symbolic idea of saying, I am the guardian of the city. I am the owner of the city. And so the ruler wears a crown like this. When we get to the Romans, okay, we have a goddess named Tyche, and she is considered the guardian of the cities. And she is also the goddess of fortune, good fortune, bad fortune. And when she's depicted in statues or in mosaics, She's always wearing a crown that is a city skyline, right? And we have this in different cities with different skylines. So Yerushalayim Shel Zahav is not original to us. We took it, gave it our own interpretation, we gave it our own spin with Rabbi Akiva, but it's something that existed in the Roman world and even earlier than that. The Romans called it a corona muralis, which means a walled crown. But after the destruction of the temple, Chazal made all kinds of decrees, and one of them is that brides would go out with this Yerushalayim Shel Zahav, and the rabbis decreed, no, you shouldn't do that anymore. We're in a time of mourning. How tragic and ironic would it be? The temple has been destroyed. Jerusalem has been destroyed. A bride is going to go out with a tiara. That's a Yerushalayim Shel Zahav. It's not appropriate, right? So take a look at the Gemara here in Sota. At the end of Sota, we have all these rules about what's going to happen when the Beit HaMikdash is destroyed. They further taught that in the War of Titus, right, the Great Revolt, the sages decreed upon the crowns of brides. The Gemara clarifies, what are the crowns of brides? Rabbi Bar Bar Chana says, Rabbi Yochanan says, a city of gold. City of gold is what we're talking about. Today, there are jewelers in Jerusalem. One of them is Hadaya, the other one is this Ye'ela, that are creating these tiaras in the rebuilt city of Jerusalem, and there are brides that will wear them. So that's just a beautiful idea. Okay, once we're talking about weddings, we'll move aside from only women for a minute, and we'll talk about brides and grooms. So we have this phrase, this word that's called an apirion. We hear about it already in Tanakh, and then Chazal use the same word. In Tanakh, it appears once, right? It's a hapax legomena. It's a word that appears only once in the Bible. It's in the Song of Songs. Apirion asalo hamelech Shlomo me'atzei Lebanon. King Solomon made himself an apirion of wood from Lebanon. Now, it, being that it appears only once, right? It's hard to know what it means because it appears only once. So you have to look at the context. And in the context, it's talking about a bride, right? The pasuk before, iti milevanon kala. Oh, sorry. Wrong verse. Sorry, I'm just looking it up. Right. Okay. Right. Apiriona salo hamelch Shlomo, and then two verses later, Tzena arena benot Sion bamelch Shlomo ba'atara sheitralo imo biyom chatunato. Go out, girls of Jerusalem, and see the crown that King Solomon wore on his wedding day. So apirion seems to be something that you have on your wedding day. What is this thing, right? So we're not 100% sure what is the origin of it. Maybe it comes from Greek, maybe it comes from Sanskrit. We don't know, but Chazal already understood it as a palanquin, as a litter that is carried by people, and it's a way of transporting people in style, in honor, right? So you have this beautiful, if perhaps anachronistic image. Rav Yehuda Bar Zevina said he performed an act of marriage, right? This is talking about Amram and Yocheved, how Miriam convinced Amram to go back and to take Yocheved back as his wife, so that they could have more children. This is during the time when with the decrees in Egypt, right? He sat her in an apirion, and Aaron and Miriam danced before her, and the ministering angel said, a joyful mother of children. Right? So this beautiful image. A very different kind of image, also talking about this apirion, but in the Gemara in Yevamot, it talks about how a bride whose father died, her mother and her brother can marry her off, but she is allowed to refuse. She is allowed to say, I'm not interested in this guy you chose for me. Right? Not the same. She can't do that with her father if she's a minor. But if she's a minor, it's her mother and her brother, she can refuse. Not only can she can refuse at the last second. Rabbi Yehuda said, even if she is sitting in an apirion, going from her father's house to her husband's house, and she said along the way, I do not want so and so as my husband, this constitutes a refusal, right? I always think of it as like, you know, those movies, like think of The Graduate, where she runs away, she's wearing her wedding dress. I'm not interested. I don't want, no, I changed my mind. I'm not interested. And even when she's sitting in this fancy apirion, she can still say no. Okay. We hear about it. Same thing like what we said before. just like after the Great Revolt, brides couldn't wear a city of gold. After the Bar Kochba revolt, a bride may not go out in imperion inside the city. Our later sages permitted a bride to go out in imperion inside the city. Right? And we also have in the Gemara in Sota talks about crowns that grooms would wear. Okay, we have all kinds of fabulous crowns. Crowns of salt and sulfur, myrtle and rose, reeds and bulrushes. It needs a lot of imagination, right? What does this mean? What kind of crowns are we talking about? Are we talking about wreaths, right? Are we talking about, Rashi talks about a crown of salt that people would actually engrave on the salt, all kinds of pictures. It's kind of wild. We have statues that go back to the Greeks, and even today, the Greek Orthodox Church, when brides and grooms get married, they wear crowns. It's a crown called the Stephan. We see it here. It's just a beautiful kind of a window into what did weddings look like, right? We know what our weddings look like. Did Chazal, weddings in the time of Chazal look the same, right? So we already see they have different kinds of crowns. They have different kinds of conveyances. There's a lot of celebration. Similar to us, but very different. Okay, we're talking about clothing. Let's talk about clothing of men for a minute. Okay, what did men wear? So again, let's go back to Shabbat. Shabbat is so helpful to us. So Rabbi Yossi is talking about, what if there's a fire? How many clothes can I save from my house? Right? You obviously can save yourself, but are you allowed to carry into, again, into the public space? You're allowed to carry clothing. Well, I don't want to be left without any clothing. On the other hand, am I allowed to carry on Shabbat? So here's our clever way of doing this. You can carry whatever you can wear. And Rabbi Yossi says you can carry up to 18 garments, right? And these are the 18 garments. Now, it's kind of a funny description because clearly these are not things that you would wear all at the same time. But in order to save them from the fire, you can wear them all at the same time. Now, what are they? We have a lot of different things. Again, here we have all these different names. We're not going to go into them, but interesting that a lot of the names here are Greek names. Unkalai, punda, kalbus, not the names we have in Tanakh. What are they? A cloak, a cape, a belt, a wide linen garment, right? Another kind of a cloak. A robe worn against the skin, right? Like underwear. A robe wrapped above, a kerchief, two straps, two shoes, two socks, two tall boots, a belt, a hat, a scarf. What's not mentioned here? A tallit. Okay, now these are everyday garments that everyday men would wear. A tallit was something that was worn by scholars or by important people. Now, what's a tallit? A tallit, like most clothing that people wore in the ancient world, was a square or a rectangle of fabric that was shaped and draped and folded and held in place by a pin. Okay, but a tallit seems to be something that was a little bit fancier, and that was worn by somebody either who was important or who was important in Torah, right? A scholar. So we have Rav Yehuda said that Rav says anyone who glorifies himself by wearing a tallit of a Torah scholar, but he is not a Torah scholar, he will not be brought within the boundary of the Holy One, blessed be He. Right? Another source from Bava Batra. How does a Torah scholar wear his tallit so that a hand breadth of the garment worn under his clothes is not visible from beneath it? So he's wearing other stuff, but the tallit is a signifier of his status, of how important he is, not necessarily how rich he is. All right, take a look at the last source here. It was said about Rabbi Yehuda Bar Ilai that six of his students would cover themselves with one tallit and they would engage in Torah study. They were very poor. They were very cold. But what does a Torah scholar wear? He wears a tallit. Tallit comes from the word talal, okay, to wrap or to drape. And one of the things that gave status that showed that tallit was an important garment was the fact that it had stripes. In the Roman world, if you had stripes on your clothing, it's called latus clavus. That means you're an important guy, right? And we actually see this in a fascinating way in depictions from the time. Okay, so if you look at the top picture here, this is a depiction of the Akedah, again from the synagogue in Beit Alpha. Okay? And you can see it's got a lot of different people here. Okay, you've got Yitzchak; he's about to go onto the fire. We've got Avraham. We've got the Sela Ola, right? We've got the ram who's going to be sacrificed ultimately instead of Yitzchak. We've got the angel, the hand saying, Al Tishlach Yadcha Al Hanar. And we have the two Ne'arim, right? We have the two servants. Notice Avraham is wearing a striped cloak. The two Na'arim are wearing t-shirts. They are not important. They don't get to wear a talit. They don't get to wear something with stripes. Look at the bottom picture. This is from the synagogue in Dura Europos from the 3rd century in Syria. Fabulous paintings all over the walls. This is Shmuel HaNavi anointing David. Shmuel gets to have stripes on his robe. The others have stripes, but not as prominently. Okay, now what happened was time passed. People no longer draped themselves in clothes, and the talit, they just wore, shirts, pants, whatever. And the talit became a ritual garment, but it kept its stripes, it kept its corners, it kept its tzitzit, because as a four-corner garment, it's obligated in tzitzit. Okay? And the talit became a symbol of Judaism, and ultimately in Zionism, when we had to come up with a flag of Israel, the talit is the inspiration for the flag, right? The stripes, the white, the blue. The other talit here is a great, again, a symbol of Jewish survival. This is a talit that's on display in the museum in Heichal Shlomo in Jerusalem. It's called a talit shesardah, the talit that survived. It's a talit of someone named David ben David. He saved it from a burning synagogue during the Holocaust. He survived the Holocaust. He was on an illegal immigration ship to the land of Israel called the Patria, which drowned. He was saved. The talit was saved. He made his way to Kfar Etzion, which was conquered by the Arabs and destroyed, and the talit was saved. So the talit was saved three times from the Holocaust, from his illegal immigration, from the 1948 war, and he was saved as well. Okay, two very quick last things. Colors, okay? All these clothes, we want them to have colors. Most people do not wear colors. Colors are very expensive. You wear color if you are royal or if you are rich. Where does color come from? Color comes from plants. Color comes from animals. You need a large quantity of these colors in order to, of these objects in order to make this dye. And that's why dyeing is a very expensive process, right? We have discussions in the Gemara in Bava Kamma about what if the dyer messed up? You gave him cloth to dye and he did it wrong. He made it the wrong color. You don't get all your money back because it costs the dyer a lot of money to do this. So you're gonna split the difference. Okay? You have to give the dyer his expenses. Okay? Jews were often dyers. It was a profession that they did, probably because it was messy and had to be done outside of the town. What if you're a Kohen and you're a dyer? Rabbi Yehuda says, if your hands were colored with satis, a blue dye, you cannot lift up your hands during the Birkat Kohanim because everyone's going to stare at you. What do you use for dyeing? So the Mishnah in Shvi gives us a whole list of things. We have something called wode or satis or istatis. Okay, that's over here. The roots and the leaves of this plant, which are boiled, and then the concentrate is mixed with a base, and then it's dried, and then it's pounded, and you get this beautiful blue color. Okay, you have madder. Madder is another color, another plant called pu'ah in Hebrew, and it makes red. Those are our plants. We also have pomegranates. We also have nuts. We also have onions. You also have animals. Tolaat shani, we hear about in the Torah, and this is a worm. This picture up here, this is cloth that was dyed from the Tolaat Shani red. We also have Tchelet, we'll see in a minute. We also have another plant that's called indigo or Kela Ilan. Okay, we'll talk about that in one second. The bottom picture here is cloth that was found in the Bar Kokhba caves. Very, very rare to find such a thing. You can see it's dyed with either Tchelet or satis, we don't know, or indigo, but it shows us that rich people made their way to the Bar Kokhba caves. They also were escaping. Very interesting. The sons of Yisachar are Tola and Pu'ah, which are madder, and Tolaat Shani. Were they dyers? We don't know. And finally, Tchelet. Okay, Tchelet, which has just recently been rediscovered. How do you make this dye? Okay. We know from the Torah that you need to have a petil tchelet. The Torah doesn't tell us why. The rabbis, of course, do tell us why, because the rabbis like to tell us why for everything. So that's our last source here. Why do you need a petil techelet on your tzitzit? Techelet is similar to in color to the sea, and the sea is similar to the sky is similar to the throne of glory, the kisei hakavod. That blue makes you think of God, and that's why you need to have that techelet. Now, techelet is very hard to make. You need to make it from the shells of the murex snail. You need many, many, many snails. It's a very complicated thing. You need to add certain chemicals in order to make this dye. According to the Gemara in Menachot, the snails are very rare, and so it makes it very expensive. And people took shortcuts, and they took this other kind of a plant called a kela'ilan, indigo. That's what you see over here. And they would use that to make the tchelet because it was cheaper. And the Gemara says, God is destined to exact punishment from one who hangs ritual fringes dyed with kela'ilan and says it is dyed with tchelet. You humans might not be able to tell the difference. I, Hashem, can tell the difference. Karaites do not follow this idea that you need to have only one tchelet. They say blue, blue is blue. It could be synthetic blue. And they just take any kind of a blue thread and they add it to their tzitzit. But rabbinic Jews use only tchelet. For many, many centuries, Jews did not use tchelet in their tzitzit because they didn't know how to make it. And today, if you're into the idea of petil tchelet, you can learn all about how the methodology of making the tchelet was rediscovered, and more people today are wearing tchelet. Okay, let's take a look at questions if we have any. Okay. Okay. Yes, she had a lot of money. The women are also wearing makeup. I'm not sure if you can tell that the women are wearing makeup. Maybe, maybe. They definitely did wear makeup, for sure. We found makeup applicators from Tanakh times, for sure. But I don't know if you can see it in the pictures. So a synagogue in a minyan is considered private, more private than being outside, right? Being outside is really out in the middle of everything. Okay, let's go down. Sorry. A study hall does not have greater kedusha. Is that the source? Now I'm forgetting what the source said. Yeah, it's very likely that that would be. Okay. Rabbi Elazar HaKapar was like Capernicus. Okay, nice. But Rabbi Elazar HaKapar is not the one with Tanurosh HaAchnai. That is Rabbi Elazar HaGadol, Rabbi Elazar ben Hyrcanus. Synagogue styles were different due to finances? Not so much, meaning they're all clearly the most expensive building in the neighborhood. Okay? And the community put its money into the synagogue. That's what they did. And a small synagogue with a fabulous mosaic is not necessarily cheaper than a large, impressive facade with no mosaic. So not necessarily money. Ezrat Nashim, Af Gam Nashim. Okay, yes, meaning including the women. Yes, beautiful earrings, not a necklace. Rabbi Akiva, the ear shel zahav is not a necklace. It's a tiara. Now, today there might be ear shel zahav necklaces. I don't know. Rabbi Akiva was poor, but the Gemara talks about how he becomes rich eventually. He starts out very poor, but he becomes rich. A Perion may be from Persian. I read Sanskrit or Greek, but I'm happy to hear other derivations. Okay. Erlenmeyer flask people. I don't know what that means. If you want to explain that, Deb. The talit has corners and it has tzitzit. Yes, definitely. Lattice clavis is the stripes. And I don't know if anybody has other questions, comments. Shana tova to everybody. Perhaps we shall continue after the Chagim. I have to see if I have enough to say. But in any case, we'll also see. Hopefully, the tourists will start coming back and we will have a year of peace and good bisorot and good things for everybody. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you, Shana
Amen.
Tova, to
Shana
everybody.
Tova,
it was
Shuli.
delightful. Delightful. Toda rabba.
Tada
Thank you for
Rabbah,
all
Shana
you have
Tova.
taught.
Thank you for a wonderful, wonderful series.
Thank you,
Julie.
Not so bad.
Julie,
thank you.
The one time I was going to go on a walking tour with you, my daughter-in-law went into labor and I missed my spot.
That's a very good reason. That's okay.
The day after La Gorda, remember you did that? Yeah. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Thank you for everything. You're amazing. May we hear from you.
Shana tova.
Shana tova to everybody.
Shana tova.